From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Iowa's bad night? Wait till you see Michigan's growing stack of absentee ballots.
You can't do it all in one day and do it efficiently and accurately without being there for 24 plus hours. That's just not reasonable to ask anybody to do.
So how to avoid a tabulation train wreck? This hour, two clerks talk about what needs to happen to make sure results are delivered in a timely way. Also on the show, a new work on stage at Plowshares Theater in Detroit serves up a fascinating story about the first black megastar of the American stage. The show poses interesting questions about collaborations in the arts.
Who has the right in regards to carving the character out? Is it solely the product of the playwright, or is it the product of the actor?
What if the actor has lived the character's experience? All that and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last night was a long one for tabulators in Iowa. Longer than long, really. The heightened attention for the Democratic primary caucuses was compounded by technical problems, use of a new reporting app that led to delays, adding up to a straight-up clerical nightmare. Michigan's voting system is very different than the Iowa caucuses. And yet, as we have noted on the show, there's a great deal changing this year with an expected influx of mail-in votes as the state allows room for more absentee voting on demand. With us to talk through tabulation and logistics are Tina Barton, clerk for the City of Rochester Hills. Welcome, Tina.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on today.
And Jan Ronselli, clerk for Bloomfield Township. Jan, glad to have you.
Glad to be here.
Tina, this morning you tweeted the following. Dear Michigan legislators, I don't want to be the Iowa of the November election. We need more time. Sincerely, a Michigan clerk. What's on your mind?
So this morning when I woke up and I was watching the news, the Today Show came on, and the first thing they said is that the big news today is that there is no news. And basically referring to the fact that they had nothing to report from Iowa. I have a huge concern that with the Prop 3 changes that we saw come through and no reason absentee and the tremendous increase that we're seeing in absentee votes being cast in the state of Michigan, that we could very well wake up on the day after the election and the news could say the big news is there is no news from Michigan yet. And I don't want to be the Iowa in the November election.
So just to be clear, your concern is not we need more time before we're ready for the election, but we may well need more time to tabulate.
That's correct. We need more time to count absentee ballots, whether that be processing them prior to election day, up to the point of where they are either opened and put in batches and ready to go through the machines, or we're already putting them through the machines prior to election day. Whatever that is, we have such a high number coming in that we're anticipating our absentee teams could be spending anywhere from 20 to 24 hours just trying to process the ballots that we have coming in.
Wait, you're saying they're already starting already?
Yes, that's correct. So in August of last year, it was really the first election that we saw in Rochester Hills where Prop 3 got put into place. And over 80% of the ballots that were cast in Rochester Hills in August of last year were cast by absentee ballot.
Wow. Jan Ronselli, do you share these concerns?
Oh, I do. I do. In August of 2019, we had an election, and 50% of the people who cast a vote cast a ballot. In November, along with Rochester Hills, we had an election, and 70% of the people voting in that election cast their vote absentee.
These are such high percentages.
They're high percentages, and you can't do it all in one day and do it efficiently and accurately without being there for 24 plus hours. That's just not reasonable to ask anybody to do. It's not the tabulation, putting the ballots through the machines or the high-speed scanner. It's opening the ballots up. All right, the ballots in an envelope. The ballot is enclosed in an envelope, then it's inserted in a secrecy sleeve. It's folded. There's a stub on it. The stub has to be compared to the label on the outside of the envelope. You remove the stub, then you pass the secrecy sleeve down with the ballot in it, and that person doesn't know the identity, and they have to pull the ballot out, lay it flat on the table, backfold it so it's flat enough to go through either a stand-up tabulator or a high-speed machine. they can't do more than 200, 250 in an hour at a table. It takes forever to do that.
A physical process.
It is a feat of manual labor.
On the one hand, it's kind of gloriously analog as people's fears get ratcheted up about how the mechanization of voting tabulation might open us up to vulnerabilities. But I take your point that you just have to do this by hand, and that's time consuming.
It is.
We've spoken with State Senator Ruth Johnson about a bill she's proposed, which would, among other things, allow clerks to process ballots, get them ready for counting. And her bill gets a hearing in Lansing tomorrow before the State Senate Elections Committee. I wanted to ask both of you, maybe Jan, we'll start with you. If you were there, what would you tell the committee?
I'd tell the committee to vote yes. But Tina and I both addressed the committee last week in preparation for this vote. And while processing them ahead of time is a good thing, and they're allowing us 9 to 5, I wish it was 7 to 8. I'm willing to compromise now, but I would tell them to vote yes. Let's get started on this. We're way behind other states in handling absentee voting.
Jan Ronselli, you represent Michigan on the Standards Board for the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. From talking with your colleagues from other states, how would you gauge the amount of change that Michigan is taking on with the Prop 3 changes? I mean, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10. How big a change is this?
For Michigan, it's a huge change, okay? And it's probably an 8. Right, we're behind other states in this. There's 28 states, I think, at least, and Tina can correct me, I think there's at least 28 states that count their ballots a day or two ahead of time. They don't close the polls out, so they don't know what the end result is, but they're processing. They have a form of early voting. We have none of that. So we're taking a big leap here, but it is long overdue. And Tina and I are in communities where there's large amounts of absentee voting, and you just can't keep up with it in one day and do it accurately and efficiently.
Is there anything else that should be done to bolster the tabulation process?
Well, I'd certainly like if they filled their ballot out, they could just put it in the tabulator and have early voting be the next step. And by early, they're only putting it in the tabulator. It counts the ballot, but you don't close out the polls till 8 o'clock on election day.
I would also like to add that the Bipartisan Policy Center just released a report in the month of January. And one of their recommendations is that election administrators should be permitted to process any of the absentee ballots beginning at least 7 days prior to election day. So that's something that's coming from a bipartisan policy center giving us recommendations. And I feel like that's something that we should be giving a serious look at, because as Jan mentioned, while this might be new to Michigan, this is not new across the country. They've been processing ballots prior to Election Day in many, many states across the country and been doing it for a long time. And it's just something that we need to play catch up on. And I think Prop 3 has forced our hand to do that.
Near as I can tell, the caucus process in Iowa, the caucus process itself more or less went off as usual. The problem, again, was with the reporting of the results. But public reaction, and certainly to some extent media reaction, might be leading some people to believe that there was a problem with citizens having a fair and accountable say in the nomination process. It's true, we don't have results this minute as we're having this conversation, but how do we address concerns about fairness?
Fairness in Michigan elections, I feel like that is something that all clerks are concerned about. And we address that. We know who our constituents are. We make concerted efforts to educate them when there are items on the ballot. When we have elections, we make sure that that information gets out to them. As far as the legitimacy of the election, we have a great system in Michigan that we have paper ballots. We also do logic and accuracy tests that is done prior to the election, where the county is programming our elections, but the local units are actually testing it to make sure that the programming is correct. So there's a layer of accountability and checks and balances there. We also have a pretty good audit system in place, and not all states do. So they audit our processes and procedures, and then they also hand select contests on statewide basis to count those precincts by hand to make sure that the way that the machine tabulated the results is exactly what the ballots are showing. In addition to that, we have started piloting risk-limiting audits in the state of Michigan. So we've been doing that since December of 2018. Rochester Hills was actually the first community in the state to do that. And so we are moving forward with that, of piloting those in the state. And the risk-limiting audits are considered to be the gold standard of audits across the entire country.
Are you feeling heard by state leaders about the potential for problems?
I think people assume there's problems. I mean, I have to tell you, there's so many checks and balances in the state of Michigan with state procedures. It is, if you have a problem, there's a way to resolve it. Like you could have a technical problem with a piece of equipment. We have backup equipment, right? If a ballot is ripped, we have a way to repair that ballot, fix it. But there's so much fairness here. We have a public accuracy test that you have to do with the precinct prior to the election, and that's open to the public. We have all kinds of ways that we get out the word of as to what's on the ballot, not for them how to vote, but what they're going to encounter when they get to the precinct or when they're voting absentee. Ways for them to get more information about whatever's on the ballot. Michigan is a very fair state.
But in terms of your concerns about there being enough time to count the ballots and report in the manner that the public expects, are you feeling heard that state leaders get it, why this needs to be prioritized?
I would say that that's kind of a mixed reaction. I think some are concerned about that. We did have one of the senators say during the hearing that he really didn't know what the big deal was, you know, that we should kind of take down the excitement about receiving the results right away. I think he even said something along the lines that we should just take a nap and wait till tomorrow to get the results. I don't think that's what Michigan wants, and I don't think that's what our country wants. I think we have a responsibility to do things fairly, efficiently, and with integrity, and I think we can do that, and I think the legislature should trust us. We are all clerks that take an oath of office. If any clerk violates that oath, there are measures in place to deal with that. We have workers who take an oath of office that they will uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Michigan. And we do that with a lot of integrity. And I think that they should trust us that this is our profession and we know that what we're doing and we know that we need more time.
Tina Barton is clerk for the city of Rochester Hills. We've also been talking with Jan Ronselli, clerk for Bloomfield Township. It's been a pleasure having both of you on. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, a new play explores interracial friendships as experienced by one of the first nationally famous black actors in U.S. history and the playwright Eugene O'Neill.
The N in the title, the letter N, stands for the N-word. And that's the main crux of the conflict between O'Neill and Gilpin.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Some of the A-list actors that we think of today, Samuel L. Jackson, Lupita Nyong'o, Idris Elba, it's crazy to think that 100 years ago, they would not have been allowed on stage in the United States. But that's where the country was when Charles Gilpin became a star. One of the first breakout celebrities of the American stage, Gilpin is the subject of a new play at Detroit's Plowshares Theater. The play's called N, as in the first letter of the word that blew up Gilpin's relationship with the playwright Eugene O'Neill. A new work by an emerging playwright, N poses layered questions about interracial friendships, what artists of color have to do to succeed, and the nature of collaboration. Plowshares Artistic Director is Gary Anderson. Gary, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So who was Charles Gilpin for people who may not be familiar with the history?
Charles S. Gilpin was the first black dramatic star of Broadway. Charles was an actor who had caught the bug early in his career. He started out wanting to be a singer. In fact, he was part of a Jubilee Singers community in Hamilton, Ontario, performed in minstrel shows as well, and eventually gravitated to acting in shows, specifically with the Anita Bush Players, which was a early African-American theater company that was housed in Harlem in the early part of the 20th century, then got opportunities for himself as a dramatic actor on Broadway.
And yet, he was someone who had to maintain a day job, as many actors do,
but... Right.
especially African-American actors
right.
in that period.
Right. He, in this show, we have him featured as one of the jobs he did, which was he ran the elevator at Macy's in downtown New York.
The Emperor Jones was the play that really rocketed Gilpin's career to the highest levels.
It was the event because yeah. he had done some off-Broadway work. He had been in a Broadway show just the year prior when he played in Abraham. He played a small character in a production of Abraham Lincoln by John Linkletter that had gotten him attention because of the power of his performance. But yes, this was the first lead role he played in his entire life where he got significant recognition within the theater world. And his performance and the power of the show also elevated the popularity of the piece that it was eventually moved to Broadway because it was off-Broadway at the Provincetown Playhouse.
Eugene O'Neill is obviously one of the biggest names in American theater.
Mm-hmm.
Won a Pulitzer for drama, but a lot of people, of course, a lot of people do not know that he wrote this play for Charles Gilpin.
He didn't write it for Gilpin. He wrote it. There was actually another actor in the Provincetown Playhouse, a white actor. At the beginning of the 20th century, the tradition was if you wrote black characters, you might have them played by white actors in blackface, even dramatic performances. So it wasn't – there was actually a white actor, a guy named Charles Ellis, in the company who had anticipated playing Brutus Jones. It was the quality of Charles Gilpin's performance that he got the role over this white actor who they already had a relationship with.
The Emperor Jones is a story about this man who kills an acquaintance after a dice game goes sideways and goes on the lam in the Caribbean. He's on the run from the law. He's on the run from people on the island where he's hiding out. Why was the show so popular?
To be honest with you, I think there was a number of reasons why it's so popular. I think that it presented a perspective of African-American culture that was palatable at the time in the early part of the 20th century. As you said, all these things are true. Brutus Jones is a murderer. He's a thief. He manipulates and actually subjugates other black people for his power. I mean, he's cruel. He's a despot. And the reason why he eventually has to run away from them is because he knows that the cruelty of his rule is going to eventually overcome him, and they're going to want to take his life. And he sets himself up so that he can eventually live. So O'Neill has created this really horrific character. And I think that was palatable. I think when you look at the other images of the time, the black characters that are in Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith, the impression of the brutal black buck that was being presented, you have a character in Brutus Jones that is in line with that. In spite of all of those things, Charles Gilpin brought humanity and understanding to this character that gave him more dimensions than just the two-dimensional character that was actually on the page.
Who was going to see the play?
Whites. I mean, the primary audience for Broadway shows or even the members of the Provincetown Players were theater-going audience of that time and even today, which was predominantly white people. And so there was no opportunity for black people in New York to frequent the theaters. But it was successful.
So Adrian Pender's play, Anne, lays mm-hmm. out all of this
it lays
for
out,
us.
It lays out the backstory. It right. lays out what happens behind the stage.
And gets us to the point at which Charles Gilpin and Eugene O'Neill develop a friendship but ultimately fall out over mm-hmm. aspects of the play. What do we know about the temperature of their relationship?
Well, we know that it runs the gamut of over six years from 1920 when they're first introduced at an audition for the role to roughly the last revival of the production in which Gilpin has any involvement. The last 4 years of his life, we find that he eventually ends up back in Richmond. He abandons his wife. He abandons their young child. And he is living with – he dies in the home of his common-law wife at that time that was a woman that was not married to him and no longer doing theater but had been celebrated in Richmond for all of the activities and accolades that he had received.
There are scenes in this play that show us O'Neill and Gilpin sort of in this prickly phase where they're starting to get to know each other.
Right.
And O'Neill is pretty much confronted for what may be the first time in his life for how his lack of understanding for black life in America.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he's pushing back on Gilpin a little bit.
Well, you know, theirs was an interesting relationship. Part of it is that, yes, there's a dynamic between the actor and the playwright. And one of the arguments that we deal with in this play is who has the authority or who has the right in regards to carving the character out, fleshing the character out? Is it solely the product of the playwright or is it solely the product of the actor who fleshes the character out? And in fact, that's part of the conflict. The conversation about theater creation and collaboration that is in the play is enhanced because of the dynamic of race. You have a black man who sees this as the opportunity that it is to elevate himself, and he receives recognition no other black actor has received up to that time. And it becomes intoxicating. At the same time, O'Neill has something to lose here too, because this is the first show of his that made real money. He may have gotten a Pulitzer for Beyond the Horizon. He may have gotten accolades and recognitions for the earlier short plays that he had been doing. But The Emperor Jones was a bona fide commercial hit, one that was different than any of the other shows he had done prior to this because of the fact that it was so financially successful.
My guest is Gary Anderson of Plowshares Theater in Detroit. Plowshares is staging the play End this month about actor Charles Gilpin. We invited the actors who play two of the leads to share some scenes with us. T. Farrow Muhammad plays Charles Gilpin in the show. Some of his recent credits include Chicago Med and last summer's Netflix drama Black and Privileged. Lisa Loggins is an actor and line producer who's done several productions with Plowshares. She's playing Gilpin's wife, Florence. In this scene, Gilpin has just landed a role in a new play by Eugene O'Neill, who is already becoming famous. Gilpin rushes home to tell his wife, Florence.
Thanks again for staying late with the baby, Mrs. Cooper.
Florence, you won't believe what just happened.
What?
I got a part in a play, a big part.
What? How?
The Emperor Jones by Eugene O'Neill.
Ain't never heard of him before.
He's a new playwright at one of those new theaters downtown. He's a white man.
A white man is going to let you in his play?
Yes, baby.
But you're a Negro.
Yes, I know.
Must be a small part.
Look here.
The Emperor Jones by Eugene O'Neill, produced by the Provincetown Players.
It's the lead, Florence. I'm playing the Emperor Jones.
No.
Yes, baby, me.
So how much does it pay?
$50.
Say that again.
It pays $50 a week.
Oh, I can't believe it.
Baby, I told you I was going to be able to take care of you, and now I finally can.
Oh, I always knew you would. I just never thought it would come from acting.
And neither did I, but I am 40 years old, and I finally have something I can be proud of.
Oh, $50 a week. That's real money.
Now, the show may only run for a short while, maybe about 3 weeks or maybe a month, so that's only $200.
Only?
Well, you can't quit your job yet, but we can catch up.
I worked all my life, and I will work all my life. Ain't no change in that, but maybe we can save a little for the baby.
And maybe have another baby?
Charles.
I just don't want you working for white folks cleaning their houses. I want you here in our home.
We ain't there yet.
Yet.
So, how did all this happen?
Okay. All right. So, I'm working my job, working the elevator at Macy's every day, right? White folks get on, and they get off the elevator all the time. I don't even pay any attention anymore. And after lunch, a man gets on, and he says, "Excuse me, are you Charles Gilpin?" I said, "Yes." "Second floor, corsets, ladies' underlings." He says, "I'm from the Provincetown Players, and I have a part in a new play by O'Neill." "Eugene O'Neill," I say. He said, "Yes." I said, "What kind of part is this?" "Fourth floor, furniture." He said, "It's the lead." And I said, "How much does this lead pay?" He said, "We can only pay you $50, but wouldn't you like to act again?" And I said, "Yes, yes, I would." And I said, "Who are you, and where do I go?" He says, "I'm Jasper Dieter." And then he took me down to McDougal Street where the Provincetown Theater is. And they gave me a script and gave me a few minutes to look it over. And it was great. I could tell right away. O'Neill is quiet, doesn't say much, but his words on paper, I've never seen words like that before. Brutus is a ex-Pullman porter, like me. I knew him. Baby, I knew him right away. Jasper asked if I wanted him to read with me, and I said, no, I'll just read the first part of the monologue if that was all right with them. And then my shoulders went back, my voice rose, and all the noise in the theater went quiet. Everything went quiet. And I was in the jungle, scared for my life. And before I knew it, the monologue was over. O'Neill stood and asked me why I stopped. He stared at me and he said, the part is yours. Can you start rehearsal tomorrow?
Oh, Charles.
The lead. Oh, my God. There was another actor there, a white guy named Charles Ellis. He wanted the role, too. Wanted to play it in blackface, like a lot of these theaters do these days. Well, Jasper saw me in the Abraham Lincoln play, and he brought O'Neill and another man. And thank God I felt Brutus today. I took that part right out of that white man's hands.
Oh, I don't believe it.
It feels like I know Brutus. There are Brutus Joneses all over Harlem. Just men wanting to be more than what they are. Just waiting for their chance to be something great. The script, well, you know how white folks think we talk. Yeah. O'Neill has a lot of dims and dares in there for thems and theirs. It's all over the place.
Yeah, like we're all ignorant, still slaves. I was polishing silver today, and Mrs. Mason comes in and decides to tell me how to do it properly. Then she spoke real loud and slow like I didn't understand English. Woman, I was born here just like you were. I've been polishing silver all my life. I know what to do.
I know you didn't say that to her.
Of course not. I said, yes, ma'am, like I always do.
The script has a lot of that word in it, too.
Charles?
Well, they call us and they think we call each other that, too. And we don't talk like that. But I can fix it.
Yep. You're not going to fix anything. This is a chance a colored man may never have again.
I can finally show the world what I can do.
Are you listening to me? Do what they tell you to do and go where they tell you to go. It's his script. Say the words he wrote. And stay away from that bottle. Do you hear me?
I'll be fine.
Do you hear me? Just say yes, ma'am.
Farah Muhammad and Lisa Loggins, they are starring in N at Plowshares in Detroit. Thank you for the reading, first of all.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Charles Gilpin faces this decision about taking this role, which from his perspective is not even a decision at all, because
right.
He does want back in the game. But do you see things that you understand in how he has to approach what he doesn't like about the script and what he thinks is possible for himself and his family?
Yeah, I think that ultimately that's something that many actors still grapple with is looking at an opportunity, a potential opportunity,
yes.
and struggling with what may not necessarily fit right with your soul when you're playing or taking on a particular character. I think in this case, Charles Gilpin sees his character as an unsavory character, but because he is talented and skilled, he believes that he can present him in a way that is even unimagined by the writer himself. So yes, he may have a particular look on paper, but how Gilpin is going to portray him is completely different, which is going to bring a certain pride to his performance and not a regular, ordinary buffoonery that many actors have had to succumb to.
Would you two be willing to tell us about a situation that you might have been in where you made much more of a role than there was on the page?
Well, I think that there was one situation where I was given an opportunity to play a character that I was not very fond of as well. And you find yourself in that valley of decision, like, should I do this because of what could come behind it? Right. You know, other opportunities, because there are other people looking at you as well. It's not just that one director. You have the casting directors, you have other producers, you have all. And so I was able to have a conversation with the director and the writer with respect to the authenticity of what they were asking my character to do. It was for a pilot show and we were shooting in Chicago. And although the pilot never landed, we were able to make some adjustments. I thought my character was too sensitive for the time. I was playing a cop. And although I was concerned with one of the other characters who was getting into trouble, I thought that there was should be a fine line between what this officer offers to this youngster and what he doesn't, because he still has a job to do. And so once we talked with the writers and the director, we were able to make the character a little bit more authentic and a little bit more real. And so that was a struggle because I felt, I mean, I've grown up with officers, and I knew that what was written by someone who had very little
interaction with
cops, especially in urban areas. And so, but yeah, it was a challenge, but we got through it.
Yeah, and I'll say just what he said. Hopefully you have a director who allows you the creative freedom to do, you know, more with the character. And I read tons of scripts, as I know you do as well. And I was talking to Gary, our director, about this. I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to say what I will not do. So I have a supportive husband, a supportive family, and I can say, you know, I don't do this, I don't do that. The things that I hold sacred to me and my family, and how I want to be remembered in history for doing what I love to do.
T. Farrell Muhammad and Lisa Loggins, they're starring in the play N at Plowshares Theater in Detroit. The show is directed by Plowshares Gary Anderson. We'll hear more from him after a break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Gary Anderson, artistic director at Detroit's Plowshares Theater, and he's directing the play N at Plowshares, which is about the actor Charles Gilpin. Gilpin, who was African-American, became famous in the early 1920s, starring in a play by Eugene O'Neill called The Emperor Jones. Gilpin felt that the play was deeply demeaning in its language and use of stereotypes. I asked Gary Anderson about the collaboration between the playwright and the actor. This conversation between these two men feels mm-hmm. so relevant right
yeah.
now. Eugene O'Neill is saying, I created this role.
Right.
I understand
mm-hmm.
it. And Gilpin is coming back at him saying, you've never lived my life. You can't possibly understand this role as I am playing it on stage.
Well, there are certain distinct things about Brutus Jones that Charles understood intimately. The character, as it's written, is a Pullman porter. O'Neill knows absolutely nothing about Pullman porters other than the use of them when he was on a train.
He knows they exist.
He knows they exist, exactly. Charles was a Pullman porter. He understands the humiliating, derisive nature of being called George. All Pullman porters on every train in this country was never called by their real name. They were all called George because the name of the man who ran the company was George Pullman. And so that devaluing of your individuality is an aspect of the job that you had, the thing that actually kept you alive. That's a unique aspect of the character that Charles brought to it. And so when you know that as a part of their biography of Brutus Jones, you can see how when he's provided with an opportunity of leadership, of authority, he becomes a despot, much in the way that he's treated when he's on the trains as a Pullman porter. When you have the reins of power, what you do is you emulate the oppressor that oppressed you.
You don't know what else to do with your power but to oppress
exactly,
others.
Exactly. And so when you look at how Gilpin rendered the character, and you see how the dynamics of, yes, he is a horrific character. There are real terrible things about him, but they come from some context that is based in how we interpret the role. And that's not something O'Neill would have known. That's not something O'Neill would have interpreted or even thought about. It's something that this black man who actually lived that life brought to the character.
We're at a place in the culture right now where black artists are reinterpreting works by white writers in really different and exciting ways. Like, and I'm thinking of all black castings of Oklahoma that have been performed in some theaters around the country. And at the same time, there are different opportunities coming up in the wake of Hamilton by Lin-Manuel Miranda by writers of color. I mean, it's there's still a huge, huge discrepancy in American theater of the number of plays by white playwrights as playwrights of color that come up on stage. But, you know, the conversation is moving around out there. And I feel like there's more interest in seeing white writers just approach the experiences of people of color in a more real way. And the question of who is telling whose story is something that is now alive in theaters, I think, in a way that hasn't been before.
I think the conversation has always been there. I don't think we've always been willing to have it and be as frank and open about it. For me, colorblind casting, which is the black cast of Oklahoma, the example you gave, I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in reinterpreting somebody else's experience with black people. I don't want to see black people be fake white people. I am much more interested, and I've said this before to friends, that until we have exhausted all of the stories that have never been told about African Americans, known and unknown, in the 400-plus history of this country, I don't need to do a black Batman or a black Inherit the Wind or anything, because I need to exhaust all of the things, the unique aspects of my life. With regards to Hamilton, that's a fine and an exciting production, and I thoroughly enjoyed it when I saw it on Broadway. But what he does with that play, which is, again, unique, is that he reinterprets the experience of this, the founding of this country, through the eyes of people of color. And that's a different approach than taking something that is already established.
What does this play tell us about interracial friendships at that time in America?
I think that it tells you that they are far more layered and in challenged because of the differences between races. Because the power dynamic, as I was saying, the power dynamic between actor and playwright that existed is one that you naturally have. One, when we're talking about the authorship of a role, those are legitimate arguments and areas of compromise that happen in the theater because, like I said, we're a collaborative art form. The problem, however, is when there's added on with the layer of race and restrictions of race, opportunities for people of different ethnicity. Eugene O'Neill has power and access and opportunity that Charles S. Gilpin did not have. And in fact, the relationship that they try to create as equals is artificial because of the circumstances through which they live.
Does this play have something to suggest to us about those kind of friendships and professional relationships today?
I think it has a strong argument to tell in regards to when we're talking about representation. The times in which the Emperor Jones was created, there were not opportunities for black actors of Gilpin's skill to regularly work on plays written by black writers. In fact, in a few years, 1923, we're going to see the NAACP ignite an interest in developing black playwrights all over the country. So they do a call to action on writers from other art forms, poets, short story writers, to think about writing plays. That's because they're trying to build a canon from which we can start seeing works come from our authentic voice, what we call first voice. That's still important today. When we see work where characters on TV or in film are rendered by white authors and the characters are perceived as inauthentic, that challenges us specifically in regards to how true the statements are. And it's the same we feel. I know people criticize people like Martin Scorsese, whose works, with the exception of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, all have male protagonists. And you say, wouldn't it be nice if he just wrote a female character of some prominence? I don't think I want somebody who's so obviously concerned about the plight of men writing a female character. I would prefer us excel and elevate women writers to write their own stories as opposed to asking some man to do it for them. And I feel the exact same way when we're talking about people of color. I don't want white writers attempting to try to tell my story. I'd much prefer elevating writers like Adrian.
How do you feel like the pipeline is going for playwrights like Adrian and others who are bringing those stories out?
Here's the challenge. Across this country, black theaters like Plowshares are under-resourced in regards to opportunities based on the way funding structures occurred. Right now, 56% of all arts dollars coming from foundations or individuals or corporations goes to the top 2% of arts organizations. So that's more than half of all the money is spent on 2%. Those organizations have a very similar complexion and perspective culturally. And so you find that the rest of us, the other 98% of the arts field, are fighting over 44% of all the money that's left, which in fact means that many institutions of color are left out. So that means that we have to rely more on box office, which means that in many cases, many of my peers don't do new play development, because new play development cannot be guaranteed in comparison to a play that has established background or connection through a Broadway run. And that's been part of the challenge for us. I'm concerned about the pipeline not being strong enough to develop the work, which is the reason why Plowshares is focused on doing new work and newer work. The three shows we're doing this season, two of them are Michigan premieres. The third is a world premiere, never before seen. And that's a gamble we're taking because I believe that we can cultivate an audience here that is interested in seeing new work and doesn't need to see another production of A Raisin in the Sun or for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough.
Your actor in the role of Charles Gilpin is T. Farrell Muhammad.
Yes.
Will you tell us about what you feel he brings to this role?
I think he brings a sense of the energy behind the aspirations, the desire to really do the job well and also understand the cost that this role brought to Charles Gilpin. The character, in essence, is stereotypical. And so Charles had to bring more to it to try to make it something that is palatable. The N in the title, the letter N, stands for the N-word. And that's the main crux of the conflict between O'Neill and Gilpin, is the use of that word, because it's replete throughout the script. Gilpin changes it. Farrell understands what that word means and the power of it. And so he's able to bring a sense of communication to the audience about how soul-defeating it is to be put in that situation, to be forced in it, knowing that this is the way that he's going to make his living.
Your one shot at just continuing to do the thing that is your passion in life and to make a living that way and to have it be through this lens.
Right. Many, many actors, black, white, red, green, and yellow, have gotten success at some level doing something that they knew that was patently offensive, and yet they did it anyway because there's an addiction to the recognition you receive. There's an addiction to what the promise of greater work that could come following this. There's an addiction to just being recognized for your talent, which comes so infrequently. Those are the elements of the character of Charles S. Gilpin, and we're really happy to be rendering that because his story was lost to the annals of theater history. There were some rumors out there about the original production where the excuses are he got rid of him because he was drunk, which have never been substantiated in any way, shape, or form. I mean, we know all about O'Neill's drinking. I mean, he even writes it into his own plays. So we're very well aware of that. Gilpin's tragedy is that he's successful and that cost him his humanity. And Farrell is able to bring that through clearly to us on the stage.
Gary Anderson, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you.
Gary Anderson. He's the artistic director of Plowshares Theater in Detroit. He's directing Adrian Earle Pender's play entitled N through February 16th. Information's at our website at michiganradio.org. Arts and cultural coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Michigan's tart cherry farmers were dealt a devastating blow this month. Tariffs announced in late 2019 were thrown out. The industry has actually been losing money for a decade. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has the story.
Last month, an industry group for cherry farmers held a meeting in Traverse City. The gathering is usually an opportunity to network and rub shoulders with other growers, but this meeting was different.
You know, everybody came expecting a birthday party and ended up at a funeral.
That's Nels Veliket, a cherry grower from Kuwaiten. Veliket and other tart cherry farmers are struggling to stay afloat. Many thought tariffs from the federal government would help them compete with cheap foreign competition. Tariffs placed last year on Turkish cherry producers cut some imports by 80%. But the federal government revoked them, saying U.S. growers exaggerated how many cherries were coming in from Turkey and said they didn't have a big effect on prices. Veliket says that's just flat out not true, but the industry doesn't have the time or cash to appeal it. In the meantime, he expects Turkey to once again flood the U.S. market with their tart cherries.
Everybody knows what Turkey's been doing to the tart cherry industry, and that hasn't changed, isn't changing, and won't change.
At the industry meeting, several farmers said they felt helpless to fight what could be the slow death of the industry in Michigan. Dave Meister is a third-generation cherry farmer in Onekama. He expects to get 8 to 15 cents per pound for his tart cherries this year. That's about 10 cents less than last year and well below his cost of production.
My kids, neither one want anything to do with the... it doesn't take even a rocket scientist to figure out this is not working going forward. There's no way to make a decent living. You can work all day and all night and still not make minimum wage.
He says the industry has to take drastic steps to save itself, starting with a type of supply control called the Federal Marketing Order. Let's go back a bit here. Some years, cherry crops produce so many cherries that their price could plummet. It's basic supply and demand. If there's too many cherries, everyone's price goes down. To prevent this, every year, an industry board withholds a certain amount of cherries from the market. By setting those aside, some are frozen and preserved for later, they keep tart cherry prices from getting too low. In 2019, the industry voted to withhold 35% of that year's yield. Meister says he's part of a growing group of farmers that think that's a bad idea. He says, sell what you got, the argument being that would increase competition.
If you don't have a market for your fruit, probably shouldn't put it up in the freezer, probably shouldn't go borrow money, and probably shouldn't sit on inventory you don't have a sale for.
With domestic cherry growers losing more and more of the U.S. market to imports, they've been storing more and more cherries because of the marketing order, and preserving them costs money. There is a recent push to get insurance coverage on those cherries to cover some of those costs, but farmers can only hold on to them for so long before they spoil. Meister says selling all your cherries might increase demand, but that free-for-all means farm closures are inevitable. Other farmers say the tart cherry industry could really benefit from a crop failure. If supply were low, then theoretically the price would shoot back up. Now, to be clear, this federal marketing order is still very popular in the industry. On top of maintaining a healthy price, the plan includes a communal budget for marketing tart cherries as a healthy and tasty product. Here's Nels Veliket again. He says the order has been a lifesaver.
The operative phrase here is we throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot more to the federal marketing order than just supply management. But when we talk about collective data and we talk about collective marketing, you know, those are things that really do help us as an industry.
Veliket says the root of their problems are related to trade. That needs to be changed, not the marketing order. It's up for a renewal vote in March. A report from Michigan State University found the tart cherry industry brought $91 million to the state in 2016, but that has been declining at a sharp rate. Bill Knudsen is an ag economist at MSU and a co-author of that report. He says the industry may be gone in 10 years. That would mean a significant economic and cultural change to northern Michigan.
Some people may grow different crops. Some people may get in the winery business. Will you see farmland being converted into housing, all kinds of questions.
As a last-ditch push, the tart cherry industry is ramping up lobbying efforts. They want the USDA to buy more cherries for food banks and meals in prisons. They want the state to put cherries on lunch menus in public schools. In January, they filed a complaint with U.S. Customs to investigate more foreign imports from Brazil, who they say are breaking U.S. trade law. Some farmers say if all that doesn't happen soon, Michigan's cherry industry could be dead. For Stateside, I'm Max Johnston.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. That's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.